The Buddhist Society Summer School, 1976. Ferrasmeda's lecture on Saturday, the 28th of August.
Venerable sirs and friends, it is good to meet again this year under these conditions of beneficence and refresh ourselves from, shall we say, the Pyrian springs of truth, of life, and of significance in human living. But do we need to come here in order to find those Pyrian springs? Do we need to look outside us, away from ourselves? Or are these springs of the supreme reality, the essence of mind, or call it what you like, within ourselves all the time? And yet, for us as we are, in our condition of dukkha, in some form or other, to form a sangha, an association, a coming together, is, to put it in its mildest form, a considerable help. It can be much more than a help. It can be a source of inspiration, a source of power to carry on. It may even be an occasion to spark off just that something for which some, if not all of us, have already been prepared through our lives for the supreme realization. The realization that can never be put into words, that has no system or pattern of thought and concept. Little cups of the mind, the imperfect mind which necessarily perish. And therefore will always have an element of misleading us with regard to reality, with regard to truth. Because truth in the religious sense is the uncontainable. The truth itself is its own container. The truth itself is its own power which manifests itself through self-constriction, self-containment. But this vast truth, which manifests in terms of constricted forms, produces forms which, becoming self-conscious, have forgotten, if they ever remembered, that primordial reality from which each single separate manifestation emerged. This is our great problem. How to let the One Supreme, which has become the one many, which has become the many many, enable each of those many to realize, make real the oneness, the totality, the immeasurable something manifesting through particular, measurable, finite mortality. This is our problem. This is the great religious quest, the Aryan quest. If you like to put it in the words of the Buddha, seeking the unborn, seeking the unaging, the undecaying, the undying, the stainless. And he goes on to say, I won the unborn, unaging, undying, the stainless, the unsorrowing. And he uses the word asoka in that particular context. I've stressed that point because he doesn't use the word dukkha just in that sentence, but the word soka, precisely the word which is used in the Chandogya Upanishad when the sage Narada approaches his teacher Sanat Kumara and says that not having realized the supreme reality, I am the sorrowing one, and he uses the word soka. It's a very interesting little point to bear in mind. Now, if that spring of truth is within us, if each of us is indeed truth or transcendence or reality embodied, what is the meaning of searching for that truth, of seeking for that truth, of striving to attain any truth? Is there any meaning to it? I'm afraid none whatsoever in all our dictionary meanings of the word striving or attaining or seeking. They are all false meanings for this one and simple reason. Every word in every dictionary in the world deals with something finite in our individual existence as isolated, self-conscious, imperfect beings. Therefore, every meaning is self-oriented. I must attain, I must realize, I must search. And here is the fundamental mistake. This particular perishing mortal entity is trying to step down the infinite, the immeasurable, the immortal reality into a constricted state other than the constriction which the Absolute imposes upon itself. That imposition upon itself is a profound mystery which can never be solved, which can never be explained in human language or human concepts. But we, in our way, constrict and restrict anything by imposing the limitation which spells sorrow, not liberation. The Absolute self-constricting itself makes the opportunity for innumerable finite beings to realize liberation out of finitude into that dimension of transcendence which is beyond conceptualizing and verbalizing. We can't do it. So you see, we have to become, what shall I say, inside-outed, so that instead of being self-oriented and drawing the world unto ourselves all the time, or trying to draw the world, And then when we seek the religious life, not only trying to draw the world, but to draw infinity and the absolute itself unto us. Lord, what fools these mortals be, as Buck said, you see. So instead of that self-oriented outlook and activity, we have to have the totally unself-oriented activity, which will not be a case of predetermination by us, any desire by us, desire in the ordinary limited sense, the self-oriented desire, or any movement of the will by us or by any one of us seeking reality from another. In terms of the concepts, the doctrines, the dogmas, the various formulations of the great religions, we can certainly talk, we can discuss, we can argue, we can produce intellectual patterns which are more and more satisfying to this person and that person and that person, and with which this person and that person and another person will completely disagree. And so one can go on arguing away and have a very nice evening, and the records will be read by the secretary in the minutes for the next meeting. But that doesn't liberate us from dukkha. See the point? That which liberates us from dukkha is that which liberates us from our blind state of separate existence. The very word existence means that which stands out of, apart from, the unknown, the total mystery. I think, feel, strive, attain, and all the rest of it in the sphere of mortality. But I can't apply any of these things to the sphere of the deathless. And amongst the first words of the Buddha were his words, "Hearken, because the deathless has been won." And then he goes on to suggest that if you live in accord with what I try to present to you, you also, in no great time, according to your diligence, will realize that state of deathlessness. Now, that sounds as if it completely contradicts what I've said these few minutes. It doesn't at all contradict it. You will find the Buddha himself in the discourses later on saying, be free of all the constructions, the sankhata, the sankhara, whatsoever is put together, that can be taken apart. It belongs to the realm of mortality, of instability, of the anicca, the not nitya. And nitya, the Sanskrit, means the eternal. We don't know the definition of the word eternal. We think we do. What do we say when we say the eternal? That which goes on forever and ever, immutable, unchanged, and perpetual, with perpetuity in time. Which is a nonsensical definition of the eternal. Because remember, time is the expression of our mode of awareness whilst it is not in rhythm, in perfect rhythm with the pulse of creation. There's a new definition of time for you, if you like. It is, time is the expression of our own mode of awareness, which is not in rhythm with the pulse of creation. If our mode of awareness was completely in rhythm with the pulse of creation, then your attention, your mindfulness would be so complete, so perfect, that there would be no sense of a succession, of a lag, a retardation, or an acceleration with the entire creative process of the universe, whatever that may be. So, our definition of eternal is a foolish definition. Continuity in time, perpetuity in time as a separate entity talks of that which is deathful being deathless. The Buddha didn't mean anything of the sort. And if you look carefully at the whole teaching which he presented and its culmination, you will find that he did mean deathless in that supreme sense, which is indefinable. It is a state of awareness, a mode of awareness whilst the organism is alive, in which you are completely in tune with the pulse of creation. Now you see, what can dukkha mean then? I've already suggested, standing out of that which is the truth, the reality, of which the Buddha refuses to have any discussion, quite wisely, naturally. You can't discuss it. You can suggest it. You can say the word absolute, eternal, immortal, immeasurable. You can say those words, but all those words are negations of the finite, of that which we know in the little, on the little scale and in the little way. They are negations of all that. That means that they are negations of every single thing that you and I know, have striven for, have realized, have attained, have achieved, and all the rest of the stuff over which Death Lord is supreme master. And you see what it means to be a Buddhist, what it might imply in terms of living the Buddhist life. Let me hasten to add, to live the religious life, whether it is labeled Buddhist or Christian, Zarathustrian or Hindu or Jain or any other, if you look sufficiently deeply into every one of them, if you have, through practicing the disciplines to some degree or other at least, liberated yourself completely from the illusions that the disciplines can set up, then you have found, then the reality has found you. You haven't found the reality. Nirvana has manifested itself through you. The kingdom of heaven has manifested itself through you. Not that you have entered Nirvana. There is no meaning to you have entered Nirvana. You are the five skandhas, if you like, this bundle of changing aggregates, completely under the spell of mortality. Nirvana, Buddha doesn't define it. Sariputta says, the extinction of greed, the extinction of hate, the extinction of delusion is nirvana, and so forth. See, it's very important to understand these things. And yet, dukkha is presented in homely terms. Jati. Usually translated as birth and rebirth. To be born is sorrowful. Of course, one can immediately question that, is it? Is it sorrowful to be born? How lustily the newborn infant proclaims its arrival in the world. Why do we say it's a cry of sorrow? It probably, perhaps, is a cry of delight. Hooray, I'm here, the little child says, in its own language. And what a universal language. All right, we'll pass that by. Old age, sickness, decay, to be associated with what one doesn't like, not to be associated with what one likes. Death. But these are all simple, childish things if you just restrict them to their dictionary world meanings, aren't they? Any man worth not only his salt, but just a half a grain of salt, will take all that in his stride. He has to, whether he likes it or not. Why does it need an enlightened one? He who was called the giver of the deathless, why does it need that? Why does it need one like him to cross over all this? This is the first step, but it expresses the whole, in homely terms, the universality of the presentation. And this is where love in its obvious, simple, natural form comes in. What is the good of talking high philosophy? Oh, as we say in India, in Gujarati, Besagal Bhagwat. That means reading the Gita to an ox. There's no point in doing that. To the ox you must say moo or whatever you say to the moo. To the ox, you see, that is all. To you, the Gita can be read. Or the Dhammapada can be read, you see. So it expresses the extraordinary compassionateness. Here is this person, this is how it can be put to him. Here is that person. He can be taught when his mind is softened and ready, as it is put in the discourses. To him can be explained the silas, the samadhi, the panya, and so forth. To him can be explained terms like arahat and bodhisattva. To him can be explained terms like tathata and so forth. That is to say, one can talk about them, one doesn't explain anything there. When you talk of the absolute, you're just talking about it. But if your talking is a real living communication between two people who have reached that state of maturity, then the inner sparks fly, the invisible sparks fly. And there is an extraordinary transformation of consciousness taking place. Mind speaks to mind without any obstruction whatsoever, which means in actuality that two minds in complete union, in complete unity, are but one mind. When that happens, then truth in the religious sense, which is the sense of the transcendent, is present. Then that is reality, the supreme reality, as far as man is concerned. I make that proviso for a very simple reason. We are constituted in a certain way. According to our constitution, the absolute or reality or truth will be such and such as a possibility of realization for any member of the species, Homo sapiens. It is a possibility. But that possibility is limited by our own organic constitution. When the total life process has manifested through man, the supreme thing that can be manifested through man, namely the functioning of the infinite and the immeasurable and the transcendent through mortal finite man, then the process may throw up a new kind of creature beside whom, by comparison, we shall be as our pet cats or dogs are to us. So let's have no illusion. When we talk about ultimate reality and so forth, our ultimate is a small little ultimate. And good enough for us to get on with. And it takes rather long. Now, there have been various changes in the history of any particular religion. It branches off to different sects. And you may recall that we have, at least as far as what I have said all these years, has never touched Chinese or Japanese Buddhism. Now, this year, we might venture together into that field. I have been particularly struck with the basic fact that the fundamental teachings of the Buddha have the same type of broad presentation in all the different schools of Buddhism, whether it be the so-called Hinayana or the Mahayana or the Chan, the Zen school and so forth, whether you call it the gradual school or whether you call it the sudden school. I personally have no use at all for this idea that, oh yes, enlightenment can come just like that suddenly. It doesn't. What actually does happen, and I say so without fear or favor, and without any fear of contradiction, that is to say contradiction which can be upheld, is due to this simple fact. Look, if you observe life very carefully, and not only our human life, but phenomena in nature too, not only organic nature, but also in inorganic nature, and here a study of science is exceptionally valuable, you see, you find that a process goes on steadily. It goes on and on and on until there comes what we may call a critical point. In physics and chemistry, something reaches a critical temperature and a critical pressure. And at that critical point, there's a sudden change. And lo and behold, all the consequences have precipitated suddenly. Now, supposing that process were capable of consciousness, were capable of memory, It has been through 10,000 stages, and by the time it has come to the 10,000th, it has forgotten the previous 9,000 at least, you see. And then suddenly at last the result comes. Now take the stage or two just before that 10,000th. The final sort of activity, some force or other being present, has produced the change. And of course, if it's entirely concentrated on that, it will say, it all happened suddenly, it all came suddenly. This is the way the so-called sudden change takes place, whether it be in terms of enlightenment or whether it be in terms of the preparation of an organic chemical, which sometimes takes hours and hours and hours and sometimes even days of the same process going on until finally the change is complete. And this is what takes place in us. The cumulative effect and the cumulative changes that take place from moment to moment over a big span of time at last reach the critical point. And then suddenly you say, that's it. Job's done. It's finished. And that is the sudden school idea. But the sudden does not take place without the gradual. And the gradual has no meaning or significance if it didn't culminate in the sudden. And the culmination in the sudden is always the emergence into something new, something wonderful. It may be related to what went before, but it is new and wonderful in the sense that it is the final fruition, at least within the limits of time and space then, of all that went before. It's the final fruition. Now, if we look at Huineng, I got this sutra of Huineng because we are told it is the basic scripture of Zen Buddhism. And there's a most interesting autobiography which starts the work. Huineng himself is speaking about himself. And I noticed certain points which we might consider together here. When the fifth patriarch said to him, when he was just pounding rice and doing the usual menial work, "You are a native of Kwantung, a barbarian? How can you expect to be a Buddha?" asked the patriarch. And Huineng says, "I replied, although there are northern men and southern men, north and south make no difference to their Buddha nature. A barbarian is different from your holiness physically, but there is no difference in our Buddha nature." Now, let's look at that statement a little bit. How easy it is to misinterpret that. We, constituted and conditioned as we are from our birth onwards, think always in terms of bits, of finite bits. We are conscious in terms of little bits at a time. We are not conscious simultaneously of the totality. See? So, when we say our Buddha nature, just as the later Upanishads talked of your Atma and my Atma, which was a sad contradiction of the pre-Buddhistic Upanishads, which presented Atma quite differently. When we talk of our Buddha nature, my Buddha nature or your Buddha nature, the mind as a whole, especially the unconscious part of it, thinks of it in a manner analogous to the way in which it conceives my liver or my heart or my toenail or my nose or my non-stopping tongue and so on and so on. You see, that's how we think of it. We think of it in terms of separation. Little bits, bit of Buddha nature here, Buddha nature there, Buddha nature there. Is that at all possible? Question yourself. If it was a separate organ, a very, very subtle one, admittedly, you could somehow or other isolate it and put it on a silver salver and present it. But you can't isolate it. You don't know what this Buddha nature is. We call it essence of mind. All right. We've only used another pattern of words because we are clever jugglers with language. In order to impress your listener, what a clever fellow he is, isn't he marvelous and all the rest of it. You see, we use another pattern of words and say, your essence of mind. And immediately the fellow says, oh, my essence of mind. You see, my essence of mind. This is where the trouble comes. Buddha nature, as Huang Po said, Buddha is mind. Buddha is the absolute. All right. How are you going to put the absolute into any container? My Buddha, my absolute. Look at the way we shout out, my God. What is this thing? Isn't it a fundamental error? Doesn't it display our state of avidya? Our state of darkness, of blankness, of mind, of awareness. We are aware in terms which chop up, separate, discriminate in the wrong way. The parts are not related together. They are unrelated. Therefore, we are trying to picture the unpicturable in our mortal finite terms. And therefore, the picture is inevitably wrong. Buddha nature, if it indeed it is one, the one mind, the one totality, and so forth, is something which is universal. It is immeasurable. It cannot be split up. You can legitimately say, my body, which has a temporal pragmatic meaning for the present, for the time being. See, if you and I meet constantly, right, we will say, oh, hello Jim, I know you, and you know me, and so forth. But if you and I met when we were at in the infant school at the age of 4 and 5, and then never met again till we were 98, you see, we just pass each other by in proper stolid English fashion, you see. And, giving a gentle bow, perhaps, out of sheer courtesy, because we are such gentlemen. And we have completely forgotten each other. So now, this Buddha nature is something universal, something immeasurable. Obviously, if you are a northerner or a southerner, an easterner or a westerner, it can't make any difference to that which is of a dimension of being and consciousness, which so constantly negates everything that we know here. Let me suggest an analogy to help, if it is helpful. And of course, always beware of analogies, because our minds always twist them up, twist them round to suit our conditioning. Can you take a solid object and pack this into a surface? This is three-dimensional, length, breadth, depth. A surface is two-dimensional. How are you going to pack this into two dimensions? Can't. It's totally and utterly impossible. There is only one thing that can happen. This three-dimensional object can. Let us assume for the time being that although this page is a three-dimensional object, otherwise it wouldn't be, I couldn't hold it, it wouldn't be visible. Supposing this three-dimensional object touched this surface, and supposing that surface were conscious like you and I are, and very sensitive, really very finely sensitive, ready to receive that something which comes like a benediction from heaven itself, it would say, my God, what was that? That was the supreme, the ultimate reality, the absolute. And it would be quite justified in saying that. It had a touch of it. The lightning of transcendence has struck me, that paper, that surface would say, and rightly said. And remember that whereas lightning striking me, a living being, would kill me, the lightning of transcendence, when it strikes me, opens me up into a new transcendent life. It doesn't kill me. That's one extraordinary difference. So, it is possible to use language like this and say that there is no difference in our Buddha nature. And we can say it meaningfully if we keep our minds clear of the pitfalls in trying to interpret the words. Then later on, he says, may I tell your holiness, Huineng is talking, that prajna, transcendental wisdom, note transcendental wisdom, not our worldly wisdom, often rises in my mind. Uses very perfect language. It rises in my mind. The transcendent doesn't emerge out of the non-transcendent, but it can make an impact, like the three-dimensional object on the two-dimensional surface. It can make an impact. It rises in my mind when one does not go astray from one's own essence of mind. One may be called the field of merits. Note very carefully. When one does not go away astray from one's own essence of mind. Now, one's own essence of mind, I would pick a bone there. Not, I wouldn't say one's own essence of mind. When one does not go astray from the essence of mind which is permeating you, suffusing you, and succeeding in manifesting itself, one may be called the field of merits. One here refers to the existential being, to the skandhas as such. And this collection of skandhas becomes the field of merits. The word is punya. Now, we, when we say use the English word merit, we have rather a different connotation from the original meaning. Please correct me, Venerable Sir, if I'm wrong in this, because you are a Sanskrit scholar, I'm not. I'm an ignorant layman. It comes from pu, the root pu, meaning to purify. In Zarathustrian teaching, fire is called the that is to say, the divine creative fire is presented this way: Atro putrahe ahurahe mazdao. It is translated in two ways. Putrahe is translated as son of. Putra is a putta is a son. It is also from the root pu, meaning to cleanse or purify. Fire is the cleansing, the purifying agent of the Supreme, of Ramazda. See? All right. Now, when transcendence, the essence of mind, rises up in me like this, it's like a divine creative fire, to use sort of modern English and non-Buddhistic terminology by using the word divine in this context, cleansing the skandhas. So, this existential being is a field of purification. He is a purified field as such, and he is a source of purification to everything around him. Because this field is not like a field in the ordinary sense, which is lying fallow, doing nothing, just biding its time until it's ready to be sown again. You and I, each of us, is a living being. And the supreme fact of our livingness is our perpetual creativeness, although we don't know it. We don't know it, and we hinder it. And the hindrances are due to our defilements. You have, of course, the whole teaching about the hindrances fully and beautifully expounded in Theravada to start with. It is also, you'll find it also in Mahayana, you'll also find Hui Neng talking a good deal about it all. And this is where the great point of contact comes. To start with, right at the very root, the whole business about sila and the purification of the mind and the heart as the indispensable basis for the living of the holy life. Don't you believe for a moment that you'll get enlightenment suddenly by getting bludgeoned on the head? There'll probably be a funeral rather than enlightenment or anything like that. The little blow which your teacher may give you may be just that last little force, the 9999th event which produced the sudden precipitation into the light. That is all it can be, nothing more. See? All right. Into the field of merits. Now, how interesting that in the Gita too, you find Sri Krishna talking along these lines. I was intending to read you a little bit about that, but we'll leave it now because time is getting on. If you are interested, it's in the 13th discourse, in the early part of the 13th discourse of the Bhagavad Gita. And then Hui Neng ends by saying, I do not know what work your holiness would ask me to do. Little later, we find this. The patriarch, that is the fifth patriarch now, still, one day assembled all his disciples and said to them, "The question of incessant rebirth is a momentous one. day after day, instead of trying to free yourselves from this bitter sea of life and death, you seem to go after tainted merits only. And the editor has added within brackets, that is, merits which will cause rebirth. The patriarch says, yet merits will be of no help if your essence of mind is obscured. Now, supposing you have, as we say in ordinary parlance, developed all the virtues. You live the life of a saint. Or, as Bakula declared when he was 84 years of age in one of the suttas, he says, in answer to a question which was not worded too sensibly, he corrects the wording of the sentence and then answers that for 80 years I have not been aware of any feeling of sense desire and so forth, you see. And so many things like that are said. For 80 years I have not been aware. Obviously here is a man who is utterly pure, as we would say. Does that necessarily imply that this is a state of liberation, of nirvana? This is one of the very, very difficult things in connection with the living of the religious life, the holy life. The Buddha himself, you'll find it in the discourses, I'll give them to you later on, tomorrow or day after, the various discourses in which he too, like all the great teachers, points out, you have to be free of the burden of your virtues also. Now, we begin to see some significance here. The transcendence of mind, this pure essence of mind, is characterized above all things by the complete absence of every impurity. And what are the impurities, the obstructions, the things that obscure the light of the essence, which is pure mind itself? It is your and my thoughts, feelings, ideas, beliefs, convictions, virtues, capacities, and all the rest of it. Now, you can't start that way. Don't say, the teachers taught of being rid of the burden. Oh, all right, you throw away your virtues. You know what will happen if you throw away your virtues? You will become a debauchee. You will become a criminal. You will become stupid. You may be driven insane. You may commit suicide. Still worse, you might commit murder. Or in your name, deluded people, we have heard of cases in recent years in America, in the name of this religious mania, how murders are committed, ghastly murders by so-called civilized people. This is what will happen if you throw away what little virtue you have. So see to it that you make it grow. The Buddha himself says, make the skill states grow. Skill states of mind grow. See? Then there comes the point when the skill states of mind, which are associated with concepts, however sublime, beautiful, wonderful, and so forth, all those concepts also must go. And out of the infinity of Akasha and Vijnana, you enter into the no-thing, the nothing, as it might be called. Then at last you have laid down the burden completely. What's happened to you? There is a living organism present, of course, everybody can see it. You function like any other living organism, eating, drinking, sleeping, and so forth, see? But there is no such thing as your mind. That is, you are the living vehicle of transcendence. The total mind. If you like to use a theistic word, like the theistic religions do, God incarnates in you. The Buddha nature has come to full fruition in you. And then the words which the Buddha says to Aggivesana, for instance, that he enters into that state of concentration which is the first fruit, that state which is the first fruit of concentration, the Shunyata Phala Samadhi. Shunyata Phala, the fruit of emptiness. Now, when you are empty, it is the light alone which is there through the mind. The light of the mind shines unhindered. So we'll continue during the week, or at least we'll try to continue during the week, somewhat along these lines, if you are agreeable. All right? Thank you.